Hello, I'm Matthew Gwyther and welcome to this latest Family Capital podcast. And it's my great pleasure to invite an old friend of mine, Chris Blackhurst, to the show. And he has a book which he's just published called The World's Biggest Cash Machine, Manchester United, The Glazers and The Struggle for Football Soul. Chris, before Manchester United acquired them, nobody had really heard of the Glazers in this country. So give us a sort of a potted biography of where they came from, what the origins of the family Glazer business were.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they weren't that well, they're barely known in America as well. The family history is they were immigrants a long time ago now. And then it really starts with Malcolm Glazer. Malcolm Glazer was 15 when his father died. His father ran a watch and jewellery repair business in Rochester in New York, outside New York. And when his dad died, he's 15, obviously he's devastated. He effectively left school, left full-time education, took on the business, and proved to be a very astute businessman, and quickly got into, well, he expanded into jewellery and watches, but then got into real estate and shopping malls and trailer parks, and it took off from there. And they then, they went everywhere, all sorts of businesses, always Malcolm. Malcolm was in charge. And Malcolm gained a bit of a reputation on Wall Street as a second or third tier, probably third tier, leveraged buyout tycoon. And what I mean by that is he discovered very early on the art, the skill of using other people's money to buy things, provided you could pay the other people back, you were left with a very good asset. And that's really what he did. And he made himself known to the bankers on Wall Street by effectively saying, if anything tired or past it comes on the scene and you want to sell it, or they're looking for a buyer, count me in. And that's what he did. He went around America really buying pretty clapped out businesses.
I mean, he got involved in some of the most extraordinary stuff. A sausage skin company, Formica,
yeah.
Harley Davidson,
yeah.
Even a company called Zapata, which was founded by one of the Bushes, which had strong links to the CIA.
Yes, it was called Zapata. Zapata was an oil exploration company. They had oil rigs in the Caribbean. And he bought that, he took it over. And then he put all these other businesses into it. I mean, even at one stage, they effectively decided to do a complete U-turn and went into dot-com. I mean, they were in dot-com way ahead of anyone. I mean, Wall Street was laughing, really. I mean, any old rubbish, you give it to the Glazers. But they were successful. I mean, you know, they weren't in the super rich American bracket. I mean, they weren't up there. They weren't with Larry Ellison and Bill Gates, nothing like that. But they did buy the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, which was the football NFL franchise in Tampa in Florida, and they were successful.
But he got himself a bit of a reputation as a tough guy to deal with. He was described by a federal judge as a snake in sheep's clothing on one occasion.
Yeah, he was, and this is, I think, very interesting for people involved in family finance and family businesses, where the character of the family business, even going down the generations. I mean, Malcolm died in, I'm going to get this right, I think 2014. But his character lives on, and it lives on through the sons and the daughter. But go back to Malcolm. Malcolm was a very hard, ruthless, tough, never did publicity, never engaged with people, never really, I mean, it sounds awful, never really wanted people to like him. He wasn't that bothered. I mean, obviously his family liked him, but after that, you know, the rest wasn't that bothered. And he did this extraordinary thing, which, again, is relevant for people in the world of family finance and family businesses. So his father died when he was 15. He went into business, made a lot of money, started partnering the mother. And this is quite interesting. In my career in journalism and writing about business, I've come across this several times, particularly where someone's father dies when they're young. I can think of two immediately. Philip Green, the Topshop tycoon. Charles Allen, who went on to run ITV. And effectively at that point, if you're the son or the eldest son, it's all on your shoulders and you become the breadwinner. And that's what happened. And then he partnered with the mother, which actually I think is also something that Philip Green did. And they had this business partnership, very successful. And then the mother died. And the mother left everything to their six children equally. And Malcolm was having none of that. Malcolm said, I earned that money. You didn't put anything into it. These were to his four sisters and a brother. You didn't put anything into this business. I did. I worked my socks off. And it ended up, it started with what appears to have been a fist fight at a family gathering. And then it ascended or descended, anyway, which way you want to look at it, into litigation. And the litigation was extraordinary. I mean, this is a family. This isn't somebody suing a business rival or a sworn enemy. Or this is a family suing each other. How mad is that? And it lasted, check, I think I'm right in saying 12 years. He went through various sets of lawyers. Every single type of court he could go to, he went to. And then he was overheard. He was actually overheard. There's a microphone on. And in a court hearing, and they were having some downtime in the court, in the well of the court, and the microphone was on. And he was overheard saying to his lawyer, the longer we keep this going, the less there is for them. So in other words, he was draining the family estate because it was all literally all going on legal costs. That's why the judge said what he said.
Yeah. So Malcolm had six children himself.
Yeah, they all had six.
Five boys and one girl.
Yeah, Malcolm was one of six. I don't know the relevance of six in this family, but Malcolm was one of six, and then he had six children himself, five boys and one girl, yeah.
Right. Now, we're here because the Glazers bought Manchester United, one of the biggest clubs in the world. So explain to us how that purchase all goes down to an Irish racehorse.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story, and one that I tell, I beat my own drum, but I do tell it probably for the first time the way it was. What happened was that in racing, there is a race every year at York called the Gimcrack, and the Gimcrack in racing is a very prestigious race. It's not as famous as the Derby or Royal Ascot or the Grand National, but within racing, for racing aficionados, the Gimcrack is big. And the reason it's big is it's very old, it's a historic race, but whoever is the winning owner gets to make the speech at the Gimcrack dinner. And the Gimcrack dinner is a big deal. It's an opportunity for a racehorse owner to talk to the industry, to give a sort of State of the Union address. John Magnier, richest man in Ireland, had already won the Gimcrack and already made the speech before. John's quite a shy man, doesn't particularly like public speaking. And he said to the York Race Committee, you don't want to hear from me, I've got somebody you'd rather hear from. And they said, who's that? He said, Alex Ferguson, manager of Manchester United. The York Race Committee said, no, he's not the owner, he's a football manager. And by the way, isn't he a son of a shipyard worker from Glasgow? And by the way, still, isn't he a bit of a socialist? Well, they didn't like that at all. And the exact words that we conveyed were, he is not appropriate. John Magnier saw this as pure snobbishness, which it was. And he said to his trainer, Aidan O'Brien, famous racehorse trainer, find me a horse that'll win the Gimcrack. And they had two goes. The first horse they thought would, and it didn't. Second horse was called Rock of Gibraltar, and it won the Gimcrack. And Ferguson made the speech. Fine. It was quite funny. And in the Irish word, that's a good bit of crack. You know, that's what they call it. The problem was that Rock of Gibraltar was too damn good. Rock of Gibraltar went on to win its next five or six really top races. And in that year, 2001, it became the number one racehorse in the world. And everywhere it was seen as Alex Ferguson's horse. Sorry, I should have said it was registered in the names of Alex Ferguson and Susan Magnier.
But vitally, he didn't contribute any finance towards it, Ferguson.
There was a sort of Faustian pact entered where John Magnier and J.P. McManus, who aren't particularly interested in football, and they watch it, but they're not crazy about football, but they had become interested in Manchester United, and they bought some shares. And the reason they were doing that was it was about the beginning. This was the very beginning of the explosion in European football and TV. And they bought it as an investment, but they were shareholders in Manchester United. Now, they had effectively gifted half share in a horse to the manager. That isn't a good look. I mean, you know, you can dress that up every which way, but it doesn't look good. So they didn't say anything. Alex, the public assumed that he'd bought the horse or bought his share, and he never contradicted it. No one ever contradicted it. He gave on the record, he then went further and gave on the record interviews where he said, quote, when I bought the horse. You didn't buy the horse. No money changed hands. And it went on like this. And in a sense, it didn't matter because, you know, the people involved knew the truth. The Magnier and McManus knew the truth, as did Ferguson, didn't matter. But then it all went horribly wrong. And it went horribly wrong because they retired Rock of Gibraltar. He had to retire from racing, and it was going into stud, into breeding. And that's really what John Magnier does. That's his thing. And at his stud place called Coolmore in the centre of Ireland, he has bred, his team have bred, some of the world's very best, most famous, iconic racehorses. Now, at stud, Rock of Gibraltar is a £60 million plus horse. What's politely known as a cover in breeding is €150,000 a go. I'll give you some idea. John Magnier's phone goes, a Coolmore phone goes, it's Alex Ferguson, his people, wanting to come and talk about the breeding fees. And they say, what are you talking about? We do the breeding. The breeding's ours. No, no, no. The horse is half mine. I want half the... No, no, no. Next thing was a writ from Dublin, from the High Court in Dublin, and they're at war. And this... what? Who's at war? Who's at war is the manager of Manchester United and the two richest men in Ireland, John Magnier and J.P. McManus, who happen to be shareholders in Manchester United. The Manchester United board are freaked, as you would be, because this could be the end of Alex Ferguson. What's going to happen? So they put feelers out saying, effectively, they wanted some nice balancing firepower. And part of that firepower was a guy in Florida called Malcolm Glazer. Malcolm Glazer bought 3%. And really at the insistence of his son Joel, and Joel and his brother Avi, they were very much aware of the growth in European TV football. Barcelona, Juventus, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Manchester United. And at first everyone thought the Glazers were benign. They were just this people from America. The Americans were beginning to buy into European football. But then they started stake building and they bought shares and they were building, 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 softly, softly, but they were building all the time. And then the United board panicked. Who on earth are these people? What is their game plan? And for a long time, it looked as though the Glazers actually weren't going to buy the club. They were going to do something that Malcolm had taught his sons and daughter to do, which was to take strategic stakes in businesses threatened takeover. If you don't want me to take you over, you better buy me out. And he'd done that successfully. I think he did it with Harley Davidson. He certainly got form for this. But then it turned completely because the war between Ferguson and the Irish intensified. It really became vicious. Private detectives were involved. Awkward questions asked of the Man United board about Ferguson's finances, etc. It got very, very nasty indeed. And the fans, eventually it got out. And the fans took Ferguson's side against Magni and McManus. They thought, Magni and McManus by then had bought Rupert Murdoch's stake in Manchester United. They were sitting on just short of 29%. And the fans started protesting against the Irish. They hit them in the jugular. And what they did was they stopped a race, a horse race at Hereford, where J.P. McManus had a runner. That was terrible. But then, worst of all, they were threatening to attack Cheltenham. And Cheltenham races, for those boys, is the biggest thing in their world. And the Irish couldn't have this. They could not have Cheltenham threatened by a bunch of Manchester United supporters. So peace broke out between them and Ferguson. And Ferguson got, I think it was 2 or 3 million. I got 2 million, I think, as a settlement. But then the Irish delivered a coup de grace. And the coup de grace was they sold their stake to Malcolm Glazer. And Malcolm Glazer had gone over 50%. He got 28% from them. He was already on wherever it was. And suddenly, this unknown man from Florida was the owner of the world's biggest football club.
A franchise, as they call it.
Yeah.
Now, what I think I want to talk to you about now, you've given us an indication of, buying a football club is not like buying an engineering company or even a kind of, you know, a media product. It's something that is profoundly different. And they must have had hints of that, the Glazers, beforehand, because it's almost like buying a religion, isn't it, with Manchester United. You have these, and there are dozens of them, aren't there, these sort of supporters groups who think it's theirs, who think that the entity is theirs. And the relationship with the Glazer family, ever since they bought it, has been appalling with the fans, hasn't
it? Yeah, it's a source of mystery as to what the Glazers thought they were getting into. It is the case that Malcolm Glazer only said 33 words about owning Manchester United. 33. And he used the word franchise twice, I think, if not three times. Never referred to it as a club, a team. And, well, that might be the case in America. You buy franchises and you can move them around. You can move them from city to city. In this country and elsewhere, football is at the heart of the community. And it is a religion. And people view it with total unbridled passion. I mean, it's one of the biggest things in their world. I mean, literally is. Probably family, friends first, although in some cases I think the third F, football, might even come ahead of family and friends. I mean, they are that mad, you know, that rabid and that passionate. And nowhere is that more the case than at Manchester United. They've got all their legend. They've got the tragedy of Munich and the Munich air crash, the death of their star players and officials, the resurrection under Sir Matt Busby, and the great, what they even call the Holy Trinity of George Best, Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law. And these people are gods. They're not just footballers. This isn't 11 men chasing a football around a pitch. These people are idolised. And from the very word go, from the moment they first turned up at Old Trafford, Malcolm never went, by the way. He never went to Old Trafford. But from the very moment they went, they were greeted by fan protests. Why were they greeted by fan protests? If I'm honest, number one, they were American. It didn't go down well because we Brits think Americans don't get football. Second, it was well known that they'd use other people's money. It wasn't their money. And the way that the mindset of the fans work is, here is a bunch of people, totally unknown, who've come in and have in quotes, stolen our football team by using other people's money. And that was terrible from the word go. And they were immediate. The first time they went to Old Trafford, let's talk about it in the book, the first time they go to Old Trafford to meet the fans, they actually end up in the back of a police van being smuggled out of Old Trafford. I mean, they've just bought the club. And if that's not a sign. But of course, and to come back to the character of the family, the characters stemming from the patriarch, Malcolm Glazer never did PR. He never did publicity. Hated it. Couldn't see the point of it. I can count on one hand the number of interviews that Malcolm Glazer ever did. Most of them were deadly dull. And he only did them because he had to do them. They didn't do press. They didn't do interviews. So Joel Glazer gave one interview to the Manchester United TV channel. And for many, many years, that was the only interview with Joel Glazer on the record. Now, if you're buying a football club, you do PR. You do empathy. You relate to the fans. You might not like them. They might drive you mad. They might say, I mean, I quote in the book a friend of mine from my hometown, which is Barrow in Cumbria, and a guy I was at school with called Paul Casson. In a mad moment, he said he'd buy the football club. He'd made a lot of money in America. He turns up at Barrow. The very first question he's asked is, you know, when are we going to get Neymar? You know, this is a second division club. That's the way they find out. They drive you mad because their expectations are high. And don't forget, you know, and it's an important lesson here. You're a super rich person buying a football club. The fans aren't rich. The fans are ordinary people, and it's out of their pay packets. Yeah. And it matters so much to them. And if you're not engaging with them and sharing with them, being on the journey. I mean, I do go and watch Fulham. And at Fulham, bless him, Mohamed Fayed would come on the pitch and twirl his scarf before every match at home. He'd come on the pitch and he'd sing a song about, we're not Barcelona, we're not Real Madrid, we're Fulham. I mean, we used to think he was nuts, but his heart was there. And that's what the fans look for. And when you actually analyse and talk to the fans, what is it about the Glazers you don't like? And they'll say, well, they didn't use their own money. Well, they're not alone in that. Other teams have been bought with other people's money. But then it comes down to this quickly, which is they don't care. I mean, the fans say it worse than that. They use a four-letter word, but they don't give us something. Mm-hmm. And it begins with S. But they do not care.
But they do care about it commercially. And to be fair to them, they did hugely professionalise it as a business, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they made it very, yeah, very successful.
Yeah, I mean, arguably they knew more about business than they did about football. And they appointed somebody who the fans grew to hate, called Ed Woodward, who was a JP Morgan banker who worked for them on the bid. And Woodward transformed the commercial side of Manchester United. He realised immediately they've got this great brand. And it's a brand, I mean, very early on they did some audience research and they came up with this extraordinary figure of 333 million people in the world following Manchester United. It's now grown even higher, by the way. They're now claiming a billion, which is, struggled with. But they got this huge brand, massive potential, all run out of Manchester. The first thing they do is set up a secret commercial operation in London, in Pall Mall, in the smartest area of London. And there they woo sponsors. And they get sponsors. And they break every record going for sponsorship. They have sponsors. I mean, they were the first club to not just sponsor the first team shirts when they play in their matches, but to sponsor the training kit as well. Why? Because they were able to say to companies, when Manchester United train, there are more pictures of Manchester United training in the media than there are of other teams playing. And that's true. And yep. the amount of attention that's heaped on that club is mm-hmm. huge. And they were able to cash in, and they did that huge, massive. The problem was that they never took that commercial success across to the football side. But the other thing that didn't matter was that it didn't really matter how badly the team were doing on the pitch.
Yeah, well, that is fascinating, isn't it? Because you assume there's a correlation between the performance on the pitch and the amount of money that a football team brings in. And to a certain extent, that's true. If they get into the Champions League, there's going to be more TV money. But actually, they haven't been doing all that well in recent years. They've been through a number of managers since Ferguson left. They've had the worst start to the season since 1962 this season, and yet the money keeps pouring in.
Yeah.
But at the same time, those fans get angrier and angrier.
Yeah, I mean, there is a point, there's a tipping point. I'm not sure where it is, but the Glazers and the people around them will be mindful of this. But in their history, Manchester United have been relegated 5 times. And Old Trafford, the lowest crowd at Old Trafford, I think, is about 3,500. It's in the book. Imagine 3,500 in a stadium that's built to hold 70,000. Things did get that bad. Now, football has changed down the years. And one rule of thumb, which is stands pretty well, you can buy success in football to an extent. You certainly avoid relegation by spending on players. You will be getting good players. You might be paying a lot of money. And that's sort of sustained them. Although it does explain one other thing, which is Joel Glazer was one of the drivers of the European Super League. What was the point of the European Super League? The point of the European Super League to those clubs that were the founders, and they included Juventus, Barcelona, Manchester United, Liverpool, was that there was to be no relegation, certainly for the first 12 or 13 years. Well, that harks back to America. In American major league sports, there is no relegation. And not only that, the worst performing club gets the first pick on that year's college leavers. So it's always balanced out in American top sports. There's no doubt that they would love to have something like that here. The idea that you cannot be in the Champions League, the idea that you might even risk being relegated from the Premiership, the idea that you could go for seasons without doing anything, that's anathema.
Yeah.
So they would certainly like to get back to that. But it's certainly true that they were stronger on the commercial side than the football.
Okay. Now, it's become obvious in the last sort of 18 months that they might be willing to sell it, and a figure of £6 billion has been mentioned. Take us through what's going on with that, and to what extent getting a consensus among the six of the children who all own a chunk of it, effectively, how that makes making a decision about what they're going to do quite difficult.
Yeah, look, for 18 years, the Glazers owned Manchester United. Still do, as I say this. For those 18 years, they've withstood the most horrendous protests. The level of protest, we don't even scratch the surface. It's horrible. But they are in America. They are 3,000 miles away. They're relatively immune from it. They quite like owning the club. It's a calling card. They're the only football club to have a pavilion at Davos. Avi Glazer, Joel's brother, was at Davos this year, mixing with the great and the good of business and politics and finance. They love owning the club. They also do everything by consensus. Well, getting six people in a row is quite hard. Chelsea was sold because the UK government told Roman Abramovich he had to sell it after Ukraine. So it was sold. And the Glazers saw what Chelsea went for, which was roughly £4 billion. And a back of an envelope calculation would tell you immediately that Manchester United is a far, far bigger club than Chelsea. Chelsea's not even the biggest club in London. There are at least two bigger clubs. And if they've gone for four, well, we can go for a lot more than that. The figure six was mentioned early on. I joked with one of their people, was it 6 billion because there are six of them? It's a billion each. And he said, you're not far off the truth. But it's possible that they could go even higher. And within the six, the sister, Darcy, is the least interested in the club, in football. She's interested in Tampa Bay Buccaneers, but doesn't really have much time for the football. There are two other brothers who aren't that interested either, so that's three. And then the ones that are interested in the football, you've got Joel, who really is interested, Avi, who was at Davos, and Brian. And those are the only three, by the way, go to Old Trafford, have been to Old Trafford. But there's this conflict. You have to get all six to agree. And the phrase that bankers like to use, and I was taught this very early on when I was very early in my career, I was talking to a banker and he stopped me in the conversation. He said, you think that we like selling things, don't you? I said, well, don't you? He said, no. If I'd rather carry on owning something. He said, once it's gone, it's gone. And that has to be in the Glazers' mind, that if they can see, and there's all sorts of technological changes coming in football involving AR, augmented reality, which will change how we watch football. Online betting is still in its infancy. I mean, you know, if we can get online betting to the point where you will be able to literally press a button, take a bet on who is going to head that corner or what was going to happen to this free kick, bet that quick, microseconds, then it transforms it. And of course in Asia, where Manchester United are huge, massive, online betting is enormous. So there are people around the Glazers who say, no, not 6 billion, 10 billion, 10 billion. And so you're weighing it up. You're Joel Glazer. Do I stick? Do I twist? What do I do? Do I sell or do I hang out for more?
Who's got that kind of money?
Well, this is the problem. The world narrows down. There are people in the world with that sort of money. But football is notoriously fickle, even at that level. Finding multi-billionaires, well, quite a lot of those were Russian. They're not going to be buying anything. It boils down, really, to a handful of people. And in the case of Manchester United, there was quite a bit of interest at first, and then it fell away. And it really boiled down to three types. One was Sheikh Yassim of Qatar, and that was really on the back of Qatar having a very successful World Cup. They saw what that could achieve in terms of goodwill and all that. So there's Sheikh Yassim, there's Jim Ratcliffe, who's Britain's richest man, who owns Ineos, the chemical company. And then there was a third group who were really American investment funds, and they were looking really to put money in and take money out at very high interest. And it seems to have boiled down to just one now, where Sheikh Yassim, I think, finally lost patience. Chelsea was sold. There were five bidders for Chelsea, and it was sold in 3 months. We're now nearly coming up to a year at Manchester United. One bidder left, and they still haven't announced the sale. Sheikh Yassim lost patience, although, you know, could be told this afternoon that he's still in. We don't know, but officially he's lost patience. That really leaves Ratcliffe. Jim Ratcliffe might be Britain's richest man, but he probably doesn't want to commit £6 billion to one thing. That's a huge amount of money, even for Jim Ratcliffe. Jim Ratcliffe in the Sunday Times Rich List, I think, was around 20, 25 billion. Well, that's a big, it's 25% of your money.
And there's no evidence, is there, that the supporters are going to be any more friendly towards him than the Glazers?
No, well, there's a big miscalculation here, which is, what the supporters want is for someone to buy the club outright. They do not want the Glazers to remain at any price. Ratcliffe almost certainly either hasn't got the money or is unwilling to spend it and take them out, or the Glazers don't want to be taken out. So where it's heading is towards some sort of partnership between Jim Ratcliffe and the Glazers. Jim Ratcliffe takes 25%, the Glazers have 75%. That will not placate the fans. There's quite a lot of propaganda going on and papers reporting that Jim Ratcliffe will be in charge of football. Well, I ask you really, how does that work? I've got 75%, you've got 25%. You say to me, I want to buy this player, and he's £100 million. Okay. 75 million of that is my money, and 25 million of it is yours. Now, I know it will be more complex than that, but that is the reality. Who's got the say over whether you buy that player? It's not going to be the 25%.
Mm-hmm.
It's the guy with 75%. So the idea that they're going to hand over the football side lock, stock and barrel to someone else, I don't believe.
And in the meantime, the team isn't really doing all that well. And also one hears that the state of Old Trafford is pretty ropey as well. The roof leaks.
Yeah, I've been to Old Trafford. I've seen where the roof leaks. It's one leak, by the way. I mean, well, let's put it in perspective. I mean, it's a big ground. It's actually a flat bit of roof. It's where there's a flat bit of roof that comes over the pitch, and at one particular point, there's a dodgy seal.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And it's a drip. And frankly, you put a bucket under it, and no one would even know. But, you know, the problem there is that Old Trafford is a spectacular ground. I go to Fulham. I sit in a stand that was built in 1901. It's got no leg room. It's got narrow wooden seats. The turnstiles must have been built for bean poles. I mean, you know, it's uncomfortable. It's horrible. But we quite like it. But if you're Manchester United, that would not do at all. Manchester United don't compare themselves. Their fans do not compare themselves with other British clubs. Maybe City
mm-hmm.
and Liverpool, but only those two. They compare themselves with Real Madrid, Barcelona, Juventus, Bayern Munich, PSG. They've all got fantastic stadiums. That's what United want.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also true of their training ground. Carrington has been allowed to fall into disrepair. It's fallen behind, shall we say, some of those other clubs and the facilities they've got. The one estimate is that whoever buys Manchester United would have to have another billion to cover either improvements or repairs to Old Trafford. There's even talk about starting again and building a whole new stadium, and to Carrington, to training ground. But you'd also need money for transfers as well.
So what's your prediction then to wrap up? Where's the club and where are the Glazers going to be in 2-3 years' time?
I think at the moment I don't see any puff of white smoke. You know, you get from the Vatican when they decide the name of the new Pope. I don't sense that. If anything happens, it will be a partnership with Ratcliffe. It will be dressed up in a way to make it look as though Ratcliffe is really calling the shots. Well, I just don't see that. I think that's where it's going to go, and I think yet again, they're probably going to change their manager because they've done that numerous times post Alex Ferguson. It must tell you something. I mean, they must realise, you know, what do we gain by changing a manager? And it's the classic thing, you know, businesses that succeed, one of the things they always have is longevity.
Yeah.
Arsene Wenger was at Arsenal for years. Bob Paisley was at Liverpool. Shankly was at Liverpool for years. Matt Busby. These are the legendary managers. Alex Ferguson. Alex Ferguson was at United for decades. That's the lesson. You know, just changing the manager, how's that going to work?
Mm. I mean, maybe that's an influence of the Americans, really, in a way, isn't it? The sport is a kind of very mature business there, and there's an acceptance that it is a business. I mean, as you said at the beginning, one of the first things he did when he bought the Tampa Bay things was to suggest moving it away from there.
That's not quite right. He was trying to buy Baltimore,
right?
And his suggestion, which is tells you everything really, and bear in mind that this was a press interview I found to the Baltimore Sun. And sitting in on the interview with his father was a young Joel Glazer, so he heard every word. Malcolm Glazer said to the interviewer, put this in context, he's trying to win the support of the people of Baltimore for his bid. So what does he say to the Baltimore press? He says, I've got this idea. If I win this franchise, I will put it in 4 American cities, and they'll play a quarter of their matches in each city, and they'll be America's team. And Joel is nodding enthusiastically, thinking, this is a great idea, Dad. And the interviewer is thinking, you must be mad. That's not Baltimore's team. That's a team that plays a quarter of its matches in Baltimore, quarter in, let's say, Seattle, quarter in Michigan. How does that work? It's crazy. The NFL, to their credit, threw the idea out. They said, no way. But that tells you quite a lot about Malcolm Glazer, that community, in terms of its links to sport, he never got, he never understood. And yes, changing a manager, taking a business decision, pragmatic decision based entirely on business, they will do that.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lesson for family finance and family businesses, which is, and it is clearly a struggle with the Glazers, that when you come to the big decisions, is it the most sensible thing in the world to have 6 people with an equal vote? Because I don't know how you achieve that. I don't know how you can get 6 people in a room and get them all to agree on something like this. Oh. There's great strengths to family businesses, huge strengths. But that isn't how other businesses who are non-family businesses work. You know, for them, it's the board, it's the chairman. They take the decisions, and the shareholders, not 6 people trying to get them all to agree at the same time.
Chris, thank you very much, and good luck
with
the book. It deserves to sell well. It's a great read.
Thank
you. Here it is, The World's Biggest Cash Machine.